Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Stephen Bush, Alva Ray and Patrick Maguire. Today, we're going to talk about the government's response to the coronavirus. You ask us about Alex Salmond's trial. And we also go through Patrick's very long profile of Keir Starmer to work out what kind of Labour leader that he'll be. And we're also planning on doing two podcasts a week now in these new times. So tune in on Mondays and Thursdays.
So it's our second socially distanced New Statesman podcast and our first in our new shape. So we will be doing this twice a week. So Anoush, we've had our first big sort of set of policy meet on income protection for people in this period in which the economy is frozen in carbonite. How did Rishi Sunak do?
So Rishi Sunak announced some measures to try and make sure that workers aren't going to be laid off in this time, even if their businesses aren't running. So that would be for employees through grants that are from the government to pay up to 80% of the salary of your workers to try and stop companies laying them off. And then on the other end of that, there are changes to the benefit system to ensure that people who are self-employed or who aren't on those direct employment contracts can get the money that they need if they don't have work coming in over this period. And it's that second group of people where the problems lie, because the measures for self-employed people or people who are on the type of contracts like casual contracts, 0 hours contracts, who don't meet the threshold for statutory sick pay, aren't going to be getting enough of the benefits that they need. First of all, because statutory sick pay itself is so low. So even the benefit equivalent of that, which they've tried to roll out for self-employed people, won't be enough for people to live on. And people who have the capital or savings above what you need to be able to claim universal credit will have to run their savings down first. But also there's a 5-week wait for universal credit still, which means that there's not really that incentive to make sure people stay inside immediately, which is basically, you know, the idea of this is to try and make sure that people aren't so hard up that they feel like they have to carry on working even if they shouldn't.
So one of the many frustrating things this weekend, I thought about a lot of the sort of media treatment of, you know, the public and indeed slightly weirdly to my surprise of the Prime Minister's response to them, was this kind of like, you know, there was that BBC photo of Columbia Flower Market, which is relatively near to where I am now socially distancing from. People just like, why are they doing this? And just like, well, because they're in the 15% of the economy that is self-employed. They have received this very time-limited stock, and if they can't sell off, they still have to pay for. And they have, as it stands at time of recording, no tangible guarantee that they will not be ruined if they go inside and let their stock rot. And kind of this whole weird debate about, oh, you know, is it time to have more draconian measures? Well, you can't in a pandemic successfully enforce draconian measures if people feel they can't stay inside. I guess, yeah, the interesting question, you know, Patrick, I know you've been doing sort of like kind of Tory MP whispering, is what do they think the cause of the sort of the delay to providing clarity to self-employed people is?
So yeah, Tory MPs are nervous about two things. One, they're nervous about the evidence from other European countries that have been on the curve, namely Italy. They're wondering why we haven't followed Italy's lead in terms of imposing a more draconian system of lockdown. If you look at Austria as well, Tory MPs say, look, they've locked down, their new cases are decreasing. Why aren't we doing the same? We're not taking this remotely seriously enough. Obviously, the temptation on the on Twitter has been to blame Dominic Cummings per Tim Shipman and Caroline Wheeler's long read yesterday for being the author of the sole author of the so-called herd immunity policy that the government pursued in the early phases of this outbreak. You do you, but that I don't think is entirely accurate or fair to pin this all on Dominic Cummings, as much as it makes for good copy. And the second thing is the sort of obverse or the reverse of the Boris Johnson electoral asset coin, right? Which was, because Boris Johnson is, you know, optimistic, in his own words the other day, boosterish, he likes delivering good news. He's an upbeat, he's a peppy speaker, he's an after dinner speaker, and, you know, has a knack for Woodhousian turns of phrase that again make for good copy in peacetime, as it were. But Tory MPs are certainly quite concerned about his ability to communicate advice, in inverted commas, which is less sort of well-meaning sartorial advice that won't kill you if you don't take to, yeah, no, I really don't think you should, you know, go and fetch your frisbee from that electrical substation. That sort of advice. So, yeah, and they're concerned about Boris Johnson's ability to communicate that clearly, which explains the unsolicited Twitter DM I got from a former cabinet minister yesterday afternoon, which just read, ah, bear in mind, I've never, ever spoken to this former cabinet minister in person. Self-isolation and probably their own children has driven them so mad that they were moved to send a long stream of vowels to yours truly.
So actually, I mean, the thing I'm kind of interested in terms of the clarity of the government's advice, Albert, do you think if you go to a park for some exercise, do you have to remain 2 metres away from everyone, including the person in your household, or just people not in your household?
I think you can stay close to the person who's in your household since you're close to them indoors anyway. And that is probably what is partly giving rise to these pictures in parks of people who don't seem to be observing that 2 metre distance rule. Is that where you're going with that?
Oh, well, no, it's more than... So it's partly that, but the thing I'm really intrigued about on my Instagram is a surprising number of people clearly do seem to think that they need to be 2 metres apart from the people they live with, which obviously you're right, they don't, but I'm just kind of intrigued as to whether or not... Yeah, I just thought I would do a kind of straw poll.
So I actually think maybe this really only applies to people my age, but there is a phenomenon of people in their sort of early and mid-20s who live in London or live in a big city who are at this time going home to their parents if they're able to work from home or have lost their job or something. People like Patrick going back to their family homes to wait out this period with them. And I think it varies by household on whether you quarantine afterwards. So I think it is possible in some households that once the Patrick Maguire equivalent has walked in the door from London or whatever, that you don't have any close contact with your family members and that you isolate yourself for about 7 days within your room or whatever, and you sort of disinfect the bathroom after you use it. I have lots of friends who've been doing that.
Yeah, I mean, not to sound inappropriately frivolous at this time of national crisis, but I spent most of my teenage years in, not this house, but a house just down the road. My parents have recently moved house, to self-isolating in my bedroom anyway. But you raise an interesting question, because one of my parents, German Shepherds, has just had a litter of 5 puppies.
How many German Shepherds do your parents have?
My parents have 3 German Shepherds.
Well, I'm never visiting you. Okay, cool.
Lucky you, because nobody's invited. Yeah, and I'm sort of looking out the window onto a residential street in Southport, and it's still quite busy out there.
I think like the interesting thing there, Albert, in terms of, like, you know, people going back, you know, to be with their families, if it, you know, which obviously is a decision various people are taking in terms of their caregiving responsibilities and how they can best facilitate them, is I do think one of the weird problems over the last weekend is people basically kind of going, well, I know I have a good reason to be out here, but you must be taking an unnecessary risk. Because, like, we don't know. Like, that is, I think, my central objection to all of those photos, is we don't know why people are doing things. Although the thing I'm finding both grimly terrifying and oddly hilarious at the moment is, obviously, I live on a street where there are loads and loads of groceries and butchers, is watching people try and guess what 2 meters apart is, and either guessing wildly over, right? I saw someone who may have been a good 5 meters away from someone. And the next person, of course, looked at that distance and went, okay, well, I need to be that far apart. So you had this like elongated queue. And on the other hand, you had some people who like, they were maybe 3 feet away from each other. And it's just like, I can see what's happened here on both instances. And it's kind of like, you know, it would be a bit like if we like took a bunch of cars, got rid of all of the street furniture and went, good luck, lads. Guess what side of the road? Yeah, guess how you need to avoid each other. And then like start doing think pieces about how people were too stupid not to crash into each other.
Who knew that the metric martyrs were right all along? This sort of halfway house between imperial and metric is utterly unintelligible to the people who need to hear this message most.
I agree. It's the same point. There's been no visual demonstration of what 2 meters actually means. And also, if you look at the actual social distancing guidelines online, there's no mention of 2 meters. It's really confusing. You know, we're talking about it here. We're all watching the press conferences every day. We're covering it. We're speaking to people on the front line and politicians too every day. And even we are unable to answer some of these questions. So I think that's when you can sort of conclude that the advice has been extremely confusing.
It is a huge communications failure, basically, isn't it? I mean, even the idea of social distancing, that I don't think adheres to any basic comms consensus. You know, you should use language that people already understand. Stay at home makes far more sense. And then this idea of staying 2 meters apart, I mean, as you were all saying, people need to be given a demonstration of what that looks like. That's all very well and good in parks, but I don't think that most pavements are 2 meters wide, or it depends where it is. But basically, if you're walking down the street and you're on the pavement, it's nigh on impossible to be over 2 meters away from someone. So you pretty much need to cross the road to avoid the person, or really like go to opposite poles of the pavement. But things like that, I mean, I think the government needs to literally provide visual demonstrations of what that would look like in practice. If people, you know, people will inevitably be going out to stretch their legs, especially people who don't have access to gardens or green spaces within their own homes. And, you know, you're going to cross paths with people on the street occasionally. You need to know what to do.
Well, contrast Boris Johnson's messaging on this to Nicola Sturgeon's, who has, you know, Nicola Sturgeon's, her line that she keeps hammering home, and it's, you know, a comms masterstroke rather than a comms failure, as most of Boris Johnson's press conferences have been, in terms of the clarity and concision of the message, is if you're carrying on as normal, you shouldn't be. Compare that to Boris Johnson on Sunday or Saturday, no, it was on Sunday actually, talking about Britons having an inalienable right to go to the pub. I mean, come on, like, you know, stop burying the lead.
I also think one of the interesting things with Boris Johnson's press conferences is this remarkable ability to talk as though he's not the person issuing the advice. That, you know, especially on Sunday when he was thanking people for what they're doing, you know, and apologizing to everyone who was forced to do something different, forced to close their pub, everyone who's had to change their way of life, everyone who's been told to. He uses the passive all the time, as though it wasn't he himself who issued that advice. He's so apologetic about it that it completely undermines his message.
That's really interesting. I hadn't actually picked up on that, but I think that's right. He kind of wants to outsource the difficult decision making, or at least the announcements on what new restrictions are in place to other people.
Yeah, I think I also hadn't spotted that at all. I think both of you are completely right. As Patrick said, there's this continual kind of like this inability to not say something interesting when he's giving a press conference. And he's just like, no, if I'm not bored of what you're saying at this point, there is no way anyone normal who's not being paid, touch wood, to watch this is paying enough attention. And then, as Alva says, there's this kind of, yeah, this weird sort of like, oh shucks, it's not me who's doing all of this stuff. I think it's interesting because one of the things we often, well, I say we, that in of itself is useless. One of the things I often complain about is a lot of media commentary acts like we are, you know, we're not participants purely by nature of, you know, do it. Yeah. So the one which always sticks with me is before the BBC debate in the last election, them saying, you know, Jo Swinson started this campaign saying she was going to be prime minister. She's not even in this debate. And it's like, but she's not in this debate because you, the BBC, didn't invite her. And Boris does that same thing where it's kind of just like, oh, you're acting as if, oh, this thing which I am the direct author of, right? Like, it is true that a lot of the journalists covering this are treating this primarily as a palace intrigue story, but they choose to invite the political journalists to the big set piece event. They choose to go to political correspondents. God knows it wouldn't be the first time that any Downing Street has said it will pick and choose who it would prefer to take questions from, right? They could choose to make sure that the big televised set piece where they announce their new measures happen with science correspondents. If they wanted to do that, they could do that.
Well, I think it's worth zooming back out to the Daily Telegraph, Max Hastings' Daily Telegraph, just to pick up something you said about Johnson being able to say anything boring. If you think about how he cut his teeth, even when he was a news reporter, he was a controversialist. There was a sort of fictitious non-fiction, if that's not to David Runciman in its sort of construction. And then when he was, you know, he was a controversialist columnist, you know, a populist mayor. He's never done, you know, and when's he respond to a crisis as London mayor? The riots, right? You know, he came back late from his holiday, and then the sum of his response was, in terms of the public facing response, was, you know, waving a broom around on Tottenham High Street. You know, it wasn't a, you know, let's get to the root of this social breakdown. It was, you know, watch apes, jolly hockey sticks, let's clean up this mess and go and play deck quoits.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like, so when you watch those press conferences, he sort of starts out and you think, okay, you know, maybe he's going to say something new, or maybe it's going to be better this time. And then you just watch him getting bored of it, which I find the most offensive thing about watching them, is you can just see that he's so rattled and so bored by the fact that it's even happening.
Well, this is exactly what Lisa Nandy was saying when I spoke to her on the podcast last week. She was saying that what she was quite careful not really to mention Boris Johnson by name until I brought him up. But I think that this was an implicit criticism of him. She was sort of saying that from a leader, you need to feel like they're invested in it and that they care and they have a stake in it too. That the person who's leading you also has a family, has people that they're worried about, is making changes to their lives, is feeling the emotions of the experience along with everyone else. And you really, I think, fundamentally don't feel like Boris Johnson is experiencing that.
Yeah, I mean, that was really represented in what he said about Mother's Day, where it was just completely muddled and confusing, whereas it was an opportunity for him to lead by example and say, oh, you know, I would have loved to see my mother this Mother's Day, but my partner is pregnant. You know, he could say all sorts of things that would be relatable to people and suggest that he has skin in this game as well. But he just looks sort of annoyed that he has to deal with it.
What does sedulously even mean? And I say this
I've never heard that.
Someone who not long ago sparked an intense row on the New Statesman web desk for filing a piece that contained the word dirigisme.
And again, I'd like to reiterate, what's wrong with the word statist?
dirigisme is a certain kind of statism, and I will stick to that position until I die.
Do write in if you've any strong opinions on Patrick's use of the word dirigisme. Also, Bette Noir and Amy Nance Grease.
Oh, I feel so seen.
Or your best word. Patrick,
Thesaurus Maguire's word of the day.
I'm control-effing my book manuscript as we speak.
But I do think there's a serious point, which is that if even Patrick is listening to a word and going, oi mate, what's that, then it shouldn't be used. And I don't know about anyone else, but I keep having stress flashbacks to the 2015 election debates, in which the most Googled term was, what is austerity? And like a bunch of political journalists, we all kind of did this kind of chin-stroking take where we went, maybe we should think about how we communicate to the outside world, and then continue to communicate with the outside world in the exact same way, right? And then obviously everyone has heard about this thing called coronavirus, but I'm really struck at the people in my life, you know, like an ex who literally has not spoken to me since telling me to fuck off in 2006, got in touch to ask about like whether or not they could see their gran because they were sufficiently confused by the thing we were reading. They were like, oh, who's the person I know who's like cursorily involved in British politics? And I just think we're once again kind of forgetting that people have heard about coronavirus, but they haven't actually heard Yeah, then like actually like these weird buzzwords of socially distanced, let alone sedulous, are words that I still do not know what it means. I just think people are getting lost in this weird rabbit warren of buzzwords.
And it is so strange from the government that was just recently elected on a campaign of Get Brexit Done that seemed to understand the need for simplicity of messaging to cut through the noise, that you needed to say that about a million times before people started to associate the Conservatives with getting Brexit done, that we don't have an equivalent simple message for a much more important thing.
Yeah, happy birthday seemed to cut through. But, you know, that's yesterday's epidemiology, right? You know, a very Boris Johnson phrase would literally be lock up your daughters, wouldn't it? Like, that's what we have to, or your grandparents in this case, or everyone, lock up yourself.
But yeah, it's odd because I don't think any of us would have, if at the start of this crisis we'd been asked to guess what we would have been saying, we thought the government was mostly doing well and mostly doing badly. I don't think we would have said, oh, well, mostly the economic stuff. Yes, they need to do more for the self-employed. Yes, there are problems with the welfare bit of it. But we wouldn't have expected to go, the income protection stuff has been done well for 75% of the workplace, but the communication is a disaster. I really don't think any of us would have thought that would be the order that they would get things right and wrong in.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So our question today is from Patrick, off the back of the news that the former Scottish First Minister, Alex Salmond, has been cleared of sexually assaulting 9 women. And he's been found by the jury not guilty on 12 of the sexual assault charges, while another was found not proven. So all of those have been cleared. Patrick, what was your question about that?
My question is, what does it mean for the future of the Scottish National Party and the independence movement in Scotland more broadly?
So part of that answer is, I guess, about the part of the broader thing that is a tragedy about it, which is whatever the rights and wrongs of this case, I think then whenever you have a situation in which a high profile case of this type ends in this type of verdict, I think it's very painful for people in general, and it brings up a difficult memory. I think many of the lessons that may be learned from this in the independence movement are not good things, right? Because innocent until proven guilty is a very important principle. However, due process is also an important principle. And I think in an odd way, this result will strengthen the hands of people who seem to think that it was almost the fact of him being found not guilty or not proven on all charges. You kind of have people almost suggesting that, oh, well, why did we even bother with the court case, which is very much not how these things should be done.
And that has already happened because already Joanna Cherry, current MP, who's going to be standing for the Scottish Parliament soon, and a Salmond protege, has already called for an inquiry into why those complaints were brought against Alex Salmond in the first place and how they were handled within the party. So I agree. I think that people may seek to delegitimise the entire process or undermine the very fact of looking into those sorts of things and undermine the idea that those things should be taken very seriously, no matter what the end verdict is.
Yeah, and the important thing is that going through a process like this for whoever is making the accusations is known to be a very distressing thing to have to do. So the only real thing that these people making the allegations would have got out of this process, other than that distress, would have been, you know, to be heard and to have their stories, whether, you know, proven or not, heard by the public and the jury and through the court reporting that was allowed. And that hasn't happened because of another all-consuming news story that has sort of disguised it. So, you know, who knows what it feels to have gone through the process of having to having to do all of the distressing stuff and not getting any of the sort of broadcast stuff in return, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and I think, because I think the odd thing is if we weren't going through this deeply surreal national, indeed global crisis, then of course it would mean that the central political question would be, what does this mean for Nicola Sturgeon's leadership of the SNP? In the, you know, the last SNP conference was the most divided, I think, the SNP conference has publicly been for some time, which, I mean, it, admittedly, you've got to adjust for inflation, and the most divided SNP conference basically means about as united as, like, Labour in 1994. But, I think one of the things that's quite striking about the kind of the Me Too effect in British politics is that it is likely that when the dust settles, the people whose careers will have been ended or at least have their end brought forward may well be Carwyn Jones, the First Minister in Wales, and Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister in Scotland, both of whom did at least take accusations, whether they were true or not, but take them fairly seriously. And I do think that is going to be leave a huge mark on British politics in general. So the Labour leadership race is coming to an end. I find it hard to believe myself, but Patrick has done how many page long profile? Patrick?
Well, at the moment, about 6,000 words. So it's a long piece of work about Keir Starmer, Keir Starmer the man, Keir Starmer the barrister, and Keir Starmer the politician. So there's lots of interesting stuff in there. Some of it, you know, I went up to York before the outbreak really broke out, as it were, to have a sit down with Keir Starmer before he addressed a half full room full of Labour members. Admittedly, it was a Friday night, and he did get about 65 people in there. So I'm not sneering at him for that. And the coronavirus outbreak had just kicked in. In terms of what people want to know, the question on everybody's lips is, who is the real Keir Starmer? In fact, Keir Starmer invited a blind retired publican from Scotland by the name of Caroline, who had asked a question at the Sky News hustings in Dewsbury. She said, "I can't see you, can't see any of you, so can all of you describe me in such a way that makes you want to vote for me?" And Keir Starmer basically said to her, "Well, come on, come with me to my constituency for a day and you can see the real me." But Caroline Adam has been given, you know, a luxury that lots of Labour members and indeed Labour MPs feel they've been denied, which is, who is the real Keir Starmer? And the answer, disappointingly for people on the right and the left, is that he is the sort of fairly old school European red-green style politician that he and you know, campaigning barrister that he you know, talks about in his campaign material. The interesting question with Keir Starmer is how his principles have interacted with the phases later in his career where he's exercised executive power. So he was always a campaigning defence barrister and then became a formative moment in his career, he cites, is when he became a human rights advisor to the Northern Ireland Policing Board, which is a body set up under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement to ensure the PSNI, actually the terms of the Patton Report, rather, which replaced the Royal Ulster Constabulary and, you know, is meant to oversee the work of the PSNI and ensure it's representative of both communities. Keir Starmer, at that point, says, you know, he'd always been anti-police. You know, he'd written articles for Trotskyite pamphlets in the 80s, or a Trotskyite pamphlet in the 80s about how the police, questioning whether the police had a, you know, who were they policing for? What were they policing? You know, did they have a legitimate role in civil society? And at that point in the early noughties, when he was advising the PSNI, he came to realise that actually he achieved more in advising the PSNI in terms of, you know, representing both communities, et cetera, and honouring its human rights obligations than he had, you know, in cases that he'd taken 5 or 6 years in the courts against police forces. And then at DPP, he came to wield executive power, and he often speaks to Labour members about running a big organisation, you know, reforming the internal culture of an organisation. And so the interesting question then is less, what does Keir Starmer believe? Well, we know what he believes, and he really believes it. It's not opposed. He believes it in the same way that Jeremy Corbyn, you know, believed that British troops should get out of Ireland in the 1970s and 80s, and, you know, that apartheid was bad. You know, Keir Starmer believes the things he still believes then, but unlike Jeremy Corbyn, and I guess this is where the question of does he really believe it come in, he collided with power at a much earlier stage in his, indeed before his political career began, in terms of wielding executive power, no disrespect to the Haringey Council Planning Committee, which is Jeremy Corbyn's last big job before the Labour leadership. So it's really interesting. And I think that answer that Keir Starmer genuinely does believe what he believes might disappoint both the people on the left who paint him as a sort of a revisionist and turncoat, and also people on the right who believe he is one of them.
Wow, so Keir Starmer really is what he says he is on the tin. I mean, it's weird because Anoush, as you know, the other scarred veteran of the 2015 general election result, does that, considering the things Keir Starmer has said and done in this campaign, do you hear that and start getting kind of flashbacks to the world's most horrible but also least surprising exit poll?
Yeah, there's definitely parallels, aren't there? But I think, I don't know, because we're in this new world of leadership where, say whatever you like about Jeremy Corbyn, but he did kind of remove those taboos on certain socialist or radical policies, if you want to call them that, that the Labour Party was kind of shy of broaching, or at least were trying to say, but in not so many words, under Ed Miliband. All of those taboos have been removed. So where Ed Miliband was like, you know, we'd let the franchises run out on the railways and then, you know, maybe they'd be taken back into public ownership, but maybe not all of them or whatever. I can't even remember the policy, but it was, you know, mealy-mouthed versions of what Jeremy Corbyn sort of said full-throatedly. Now that those barriers have been taken away, then Keir Starmer can sound like, and as Patrick has said, is one of those guys who supports these kind of big structural changes to our economy, which Ed Miliband could never quite articulate. In terms of the electability of that kind of offer, so far it's not been proven that, that really works or resonates with the public. But it means that Keir Starmer is going to sound a hell of a lot more exciting than Ed Miliband, because as a Labour leader, you don't need to be shy about the kind of policies that you're proposing anymore because of that precedent that has been set. If this is the real Keir Starmer and he believes in these things, then presumably he is going to campaign.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the really interesting things Keir and I talked about was he was talking about how his ambition at the bar, and you know, the point, you know, he was among 30 barristers to set up a then radical, well, still radical by the standards of the conservative standards of the Bar of England and Wales chambers on Doughty Street. You know, they were among the first chambers to move out of the Inns of Court and set up their own chambers to sort of break the legal cartel. He was talking about, and also the QC, Gavin Miller, who I also spoke to for the piece, were talking about how they wanted to, you know, in the courts and, you know, more broadly, unite what Hilary Wainwright, the sociologist who edits Red Pepper, called, you know, had this seminal work of feminist theory in the 80s called Beyond the fragments being the sort of vociferous liberation groups, elements of left-wing politics. Keir Starmer's ambition was always to unite, you know, within the Labour Party or behind the Labour Party, the feminist movement, you know, the environmental movement, LGBT, the LGBT movement within the Labour Party. And in a way, while it's not, you know, directly comparable, Jeremy Corbyn has, you know, in a way, and Stephen, you wrote a very good piece on this for the FT in the summer of 2016 that I come back to very often. It's sort of, you know, why is Jeremy Corbyn, you know, why has Labour avoided the fate of so many of its sister parties on the continent in terms of losing ground to a radical left party? It's because, well, Jeremy Corbyn has essentially welded both those parties together at once. You know, the British Labour Party is both, you know, the German Greens, Die Linke, and SPD at once, isn't it? So, you know, because of first past the post. So in a way, Jeremy Corbyn has sort of united the electoral fragments, if not all the liberation group fragments, in such a way, as you say, Anoush, to make Keir Starmer's job a lot easier in terms of being the Keir Starmer he always has been.
Well, it's an odd one, isn't it? Because the thing I found really fascinating is after the 2017 election result, I kept being invited to kind of, you know, various European parties to kind of talk about, you know, the socialists and social democrats to talk about, like, you know, how they could recreate what Labour had done. And the thing I would always do, because I always take the view, if you can't take someone's free food and then depress them, you shouldn't do it. I go, well, but look, while this might work under first past the post, and it did get, you know, only 10 seats to end up in a hung parliament from, you know, we shouldn't forget just how close they were in 2017. It's still the same failed coalition from a European perspective, right? It still couldn't take power with 50% of the vote plus one. But of course, the other interesting inheritance I think Keir has is that broadly most political coverage in this country, particularly on the important broadcaster, i.e. the BBC, is solely about whether or not someone is fighting with someone, right? And because of how far to the left Labour had got in 2019, I think you could probably end up with a policy position that was objectively to the left of its 2017 manifesto. But because you would have had to break a lot of China to get there, yeah, the thing that Clinton complained to Blair about in 2000, he was just like, oh, you know, the press is writing about Bush as if he's some kind of moderate because he said something mean about the right one time. And there's an awful lot of, I mean, even just abandoning the WASPI pledge, right, which you could literally have done for quite literally £58 billion less by just funding the social safety net slightly better, will make Keir look a lot more right-wing, quote-unquote, than the actual position is. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakellian, and my colleagues Stephen Bush, Alva Ray, and Patrick Maguire. We're produced by Nick Hilton. Our music is Devil by the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.